The third case for oral argument this morning is James Scott Kirwin Appellant versus Kelly Cawthorn and PKJ Inc. Appellees. For the appellant, we have Mr. N.D. Nasser Jr., an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Michael Luce, also an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Nasser, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court and counsel. In this case, we're seeking, first of all, to declare the employers, Kim Halverson, that is Kelly Cawthorn and PKJ Inc., doing business as Empire HVAC, Heating, Ventilation, and Air Conditioning. We're seeking to declare them vicariously liable to Scott and Kristen Kirwin under the agency doctrine of respondeat superior. This is for an assault committed atop the Empire Mall in Sioux Falls on June 16, 2005. The assault was committed on the person of Scott Kirwin by Kim Halverson. In addition, we are seeking to establish that Cawthorn and PKJ Inc. are also directly liable to Kirwin's in tort for the roles played in both participating in and in failing to prevent the assault. The tort counts are direct tort counts, including negligent hiring, retention, and supervision, as well as conspiracy. In addition, punitive damages will be sought. Trial court dismissed all of the plaintiff's claims against Cawthorn and PKJ Inc. on summary judgment, holding primarily that the assault was so violent as to be unforeseeable. We seek to have this court reverse that decision. Your Honors, the law in this case requires a totality of the circumstances approach. It has to be, the issues to be decided have to be decided against the background of the totality of the circumstances. So it is a fact-driven case in part. We contend that the trial court did not do that. The trial court took one element, which is the seriously criminal element of the evaluation of an employment relationship, and trumped all of the other important facts and elements that we presented. And therefore, because he gave too much weight to the single element of the violence of an assault, he did not consider properly and give proper weight to all of the other factors that are so important and that have been established and well established in our case law as important to the scope of employment. Now, in addition, the trial court made another error, and that is that we have today respondeat superior under both the apparent authority approach and the scope of employment approach, as well as the tort causes. The tests of foreseeability that apply to all three of those bodies of law are different. Now, the respondeat superior test is the same test, but when it is a leaf green approach, apparent authority being the issue, then it is viewed from the point of view of the victim. And we ask, is it fair to include this loss as an expense of the employer's business from the point of view of the victim? The foreseeability test from the scope of employment, on the other hand, from that approach, is the same test, but it is viewed from the point of view of the principal, or Cawthorn and Empire HVAC. The foreseeability test for the torts are entirely different, as these are direct conduct of the defendants that are being alleged. And that foreseeability test is simply, would a reasonable person appreciate a risk and have taken some steps to prevent it?
But in each of those tests, foreseeability is a question of fact, isn't it?
It normally is, Your Honor, but the trial court found the foreseeability to be so clear that he said as a matter of law that this assault was so violent that it was unforeseeable to the heating and air conditioning business. And we don't believe that's an accurate way to do the analysis.
Well, but our cases say it is a question of law if the deviation is marked or unusual. And isn't that essentially what the trial court did here?
That is what the trial court did. However, in doing that, the trial court did not consider all of the facts that could show that it was not marked or unusual.
For this kind of a violent assault, I mean, even if they were having trouble with competition and all this and that, how could you say that this vicious, this wasn't a poke or a shove or, you know, that kind of thing? This was, at least according to what the briefs have shown us, this was really an intentional tort.
It was an intentional tort. Of course, it was a fight that got out of hand. But the tort arose out of the course and scope of employment. And it arose for all of the factors. All the other factors support this being within the course and scope of employment, except this factor. Now, Restatement of Torts 229, Restatement of Agency 2nd, 229, lists A through J, and it lists all of the factors we consider in evaluating a scope of employment situation. And only the last of them is the seriously criminal element. Now, as the court in Iowa said, and I would like to quote this, if it's all right with the court, page 12 of my brief, we've cited this, section 231, which is the section relied upon by the trial court, of the second restatement of agency, clearly states that an act may be within the scope of employment, although consciously criminal or tortious. At most, whether or not the act is seriously criminal is but one of 10 factors we consider when determining whether conduct of an employee may be characterized as occurring within the scope of the employee's employment. Now, what we were seeking to show the trial court, and we had solid evidence presented, much of it being undisputed, was that Kelly Cawthorn had a proprietary interest in his business. He was absolutely protective of it. He had, in essence, left his old employer and taken that business on top of the Empire Mall, the heating and air conditioning business. Cawthorn was his employee. They worked together for over 10 years, side by side. They were in constant communication with radios, even when they weren't in the same area. Halverson was left in charge of Cawthorn's job when Cawthorn was not there, of Cawthorn's business when he wasn't there. Cawthorn is the alter ego, by the way, of PKJ Inc., by their own admission. Cawthorn well knew Halverson and all of his propensities. He knew he'd been an athletic individual, a wrestler, a rodeo rider. He knew he was an ex-Desert Storm combat marine. He at first denied knowing that there any prior knowledge of Halverson's violent history, despite the rap sheet that's part of the record. And it shows a lot of violence on this man's part. We impeached him in his deposition with the fact that Halverson, while working for Cawthorn and before the assault, had received a full one-year jail sentence for resisting arrest, all of which he actually was compelled to serve, and which was completed under work release to Cawthorn. And so there is no question that we have shown at least that he knows of the violent propensities of this man and his athletic capabilities.
So this was a summary judgment, so all those facts would have to be taken in the light most favorable to your client.
Yes, and what we're saying is they weren't considered, number one, the facts that should have been taken in the light most favorable to us were not considered by the trial court. And even if they were considered in any degree or could be said to have been considered, they were trumped by the use of Section 231 to the exclusion of all the factors in Section 229 of the Restatement of Agency 2nd. Okay, that's what happened in this case. Now, had we been allowed to show these things, we could show that prior to this assault, Cawthorn and Empire had very strong, bitter feelings about Carrier. They tried to exert pressure on them for years.
Now, that was in front of the court as well?
Oh, yes, yes.
In the form of an affidavit or what?
No, there were depositions.
Okay.
And in fact, this testimony comes from Kelly Cawthorn. He admits it.
And,
he did
and
not
it was
want...
in front of the perpetrator here, too? The employee?
What was in front of the...
The bitter feelings about the other.
Oh, not... Now, that's a great question. It obviously appeared to have been from the incident. What I have is I have both Cawthorn and Halverson denying knowledge on the other's part and me having to try to do it with circumstantial evidence. And so, and that's what we did. We set up the circumstances. We showed motive, opportunity, all of that. And now the other part of this is that on June 15, 2005, Cawthorn himself scheduled himself to be on the roof of the Empire Mall at the same time as Curlin. And he testified that he saw Curlin working on a mall unit, and he realized that his business was not going to receive the mall contract. He got angry, and he admits he got angry, and he rapidly and angrily approached Curlin from a great distance. And he says, for no other purpose than, I just felt compelled to go over there and ask him who he was and what he was doing. Cawthorn was very, very angry and was yelling the most foul of profanity, and I'm sure you've read the brief. This was not a minor incident. Curlin said, I've never seen a man that angry in my entire life. He was Cawthorn batted Curlin's hand away, which was offered in friendship. He accused Curlin and Carrier of taking food out of the baby's mouths, and they were taking work away from Empire HVAC and its workers. He was very angry. Finally, Curlin called the mall manager to intervene and said... you know, the mall manager said, leave him alone. I don't want you, Cawthorn, to have any further contact with him. And, of course, Cawthorn didn't. Cawthorn informed Curlin he was going to harass Carrier every chance he got in order to make it impossible for Carrier to get work in the Sioux Falls area. Cawthorn stated he would be calling other heating, ventilation, and air conditioning contractors to get them to avoid utilizing Carrier for work in Sioux Falls, and he stated that he, Curlin, would never work in Sioux Falls again. Now, Cawthorn then admits that he assigns Halverson his work and where he's supposed to be, including the atop the Empire Mall on June 16, 2005. And remember also, they're in constant phone conversation by their own testimony. Access to the roof of the mall is restricted to the employees of vendors such as Empire HVAC. You have to sign in. It's carefully monitored. Halverson can only be there because of his contact, his nexus with Empire HVAC. It's the only way he has access to it.
Could a finder of fact, I know that the court looked at this and said, well, the finder of fact would have to look at what an HVAC business does, and this goes way outside of that. But in the terms of what you're describing, the animosity that the Cawthorn has and the animosity that obviously Halverson demonstrated, could a finder of fact say, well, there's more than just, this business has more than just doing HVAC work. It also is in the business of scaring off and intimidating competitors.
That's our point exactly.
Does the law allow that to be done, though, or do we still have to look strictly at what a typical HVAC business does?
You hit the issue right on the head, because the trial court did look strictly at what a boilerplate HVAC company would be like. And he just said, I can't see this as being part of HVAC business. Now, if you do that approach, you're never going to have a tort that is going to be responsible, where the master is responsible for the servant's conduct. You have to look at the totality of the circumstances in this case. And we have to look at the motives. Quite frankly, we believe we've shown a solid case where a jury could conclude that Cawthorn probably put him up to the assault. We think we could show that. Now, then we're outside of direct respondeat, of the indirect respondeat.
Do you have any evidence of that other than what you said earlier, or is that just your guess or hope or what?
It's circumstantial evidence, because that's what you have when people deny their involvement. And that's what you have in every case.
That's what you want to argue to the jury.
Oh, absolutely we want to.
Yeah.
And we should have been able to. And if you take these facts and all their inferences in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs, we should have been entitled to argue those facts to the jury.
But you don't have to prove that, do you? I mean, wouldn't you only have to show that Cawthorne shares the same animus that Halverson shares, and Cawthorne says, well, I'm going to send him up there. He already knows how I feel. And you don't have to say anything. And isn't that, couldn't the trier of fact say, well, wait a minute, that might be within the scope of this business, because this business isn't just HVAC. This business is in maintaining their client base and not letting anybody else intrude on them.
Exactly. If you narrow the scope of your inquiry to just a typical HVAC business, then you lose all my facts. And that's what happened in the case. That's what happened. We have to bring those facts in to understand the truth. And so we need to know how Cawthorne felt, how they worked together day in and day out, how they were in constant contact with each other, how Cawthorne knew his violent propensities. He knew these things about him. It is so unlikely that Cawthorne had no clue that Halverson would do something like this. It is so unlikely that we're perverting the interpretation of the facts to conclude, as a matter of law, that he didn't know. We're just ignoring a lot of key things. Halverson bailed him out of jail after the assault and kept him employed until 2007. There's an issue of ratification there. He was a manager. He was, by Cawthorne's own testimony, Halverson is left in charge when Cawthorne is not there. He's managerial. Cawthorne admits knowing that Halverson, while working on the mall roof, is in a captive, isolated area where he would be with five or six competitors up there all by themselves. And in fact, Cawthorne testified he fully expected the carrier employee to be there working. And so, now a criminal jury trial convicted the defendant Halverson of only simple assault. And so, I think, although we contend it was an egregious assault, is it like a shooting? Is it like a bludgeoning where you've got so violent a conduct that it can only be for your own purpose? Or, this is one of the issues, is this conduct so integrally tied to the master's benefit that it partially, at least, serves the master's purpose?
Did the trial court know it was just a simple assault conviction?
Yes. Yeah.
Were the injuries stated in the record?
Yes.
And how serious were the injuries?
Pushed him up against the building twice, a metal building, and cold cocked him. When he was out cold, he kicked him in the head once. Or he claims once.
Yeah, but what are the injuries? That's what.
Oh, there's a closed head injury. There's an emotional component to it. He's very afraid of going in situations like that. There's testimony about all of that from his coworkers. So there was an injury here, a mild traumatic brain injury.
Is there an implication that if he only hurt him half as bad, it would have been less seriously criminal?
That's a great question, because I'm not sure what the restatement really is concluding about that. Section 245 of Agency Second is the section that would normally deal with that, not 231. And so, and that would appear to allow you to go well beyond appropriate and reasonable force to protect the master's property. I mean, and still leave the master responsible, even beyond anything that the master expected. And so that's kind of, looks like my time is about out. I would also draw the court's attention to section 317 of the restatement of torts, because that is the big key in that we've adopted in this state. And please apply the foreseeability test in the proper manner. Look at how the trial court did it, and I believe you'll see that he applied the very same test to torts as he did for the respondeat superior allegations that we've made. And finally, I don't know how you can have it both ways. This, if you knock down the conspiracy, you have to, and you do it for the reason that the person is outside the scope of employment. I'm sorry, if you knock down respondeat superior for that reason, that he's outside employment, then you have to allow the conspiracy and the torts.
Thank you, Mr. Nasser. Mr. Lewis, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. I realize that the process in this court reviewing summary judgment is often difficult, because, or any appeal for the matter of the factual discussions that are made in arguments, and I'm cautious about making any statements as to what's in the record without that being clearly set forth. I've just heard some arguments by Mr. Nasser as to what's in the record. I'm not clear, frankly, that a lot of that is in the record. He particularly relies on, which makes sense if I'm reviewing this, that this my client, and my clients are twofold. Kelly Cawthorn, who's the owner of this business. This is a small business. He has, I think he said, 5 employees at the highest of times. Talks about, the record shows that Mr. Halverson was a manager. Well, I guess the record shows that he said that on jobs when he's not there, he puts Kim in charge in a small business. I don't know if that's the same as calling him a manager. There's nothing that indicates he's a manager. But I have two clients, and they seem to be, unfortunately for the court, I don't think clarified in the briefs, as to these arguments applying to both of them. This is a corporation. Kelly Cawthorn is the owner, principal stockholder, and he's being sued under respondeat superior for some of the same allegations that are made against the corporation. There's no differentiation made. Likewise with the evidence. An important point that was brought up was that at this discussion that Kelly had the day before, on June 15th, Kelly said, "I'm going to harass you and your employees." Something to that effect was just stated. To me, that sounds like a mission. That's a pretty important fact. That's not part of this record. What is included in this record is the deposition of Mr. Halverson, the plaintiff. He talked about this incident on June 15th, and he said that my client wasn't happy with him. He wasn't. He said how, "You're taking your carrier, you're my supplier, and now you're my competitor, and you're taking business away from me, and I have to feed my family and my employees too." He made those comments. He did not say, "I'm going to follow you to the ends of the earth and harass you." This is a lot like what the court had to address in Werner, where there is deposition testimony. And again, on page 28 of the deposition, which is part of Rochelle Cundy's affidavit, it's even Mr. Halverson said, "I was not physically threatened in that conversation on the 15th. If this was the mission of Kelly Cawthorn and his corporation to go out and try to pursue intimidation, threatening and everything, wouldn't he have threatened him on that day? Even the plaintiff admits it was not done. In Werner, the court recognized that you cannot create fact questions, as Justice Zinner noted, by talking about what you want to conclude in final argument. You can't create it by assertions and denials. You need to specifically look at what's in the record and what specific facts you have identified. That's my duty as an officer of the court in presenting these matters on appeal, and I don't believe the specific facts support what is being said here. And the final argument that would like to be asserted, that the two of them combined on a mission to conspire and to intimidate and to hurt Mr. Halverson. This was a rough encounter, an encounter that none of us as followers of the law permit. He was criminally prosecuted, Mr. Halverson, for that. There's still going to be a trial. Mr. Halverson has been sued. That's not part of this appeal. From a civil end to what's already happened from a criminal end. Mr. Nasser said there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, a lot of inferences that can be drawn. This is not a matter that was briefly discovered. This was the course of a criminal investigation. Do you think law enforcement, if in fact there was some conspiracy and some joint efforts to go out and harass people and hurt people, that Mr. Cawthorn would have also been held accountable?
But isn't that a jury argument also?
It's a jury argument as to what his role was. It's not a jury argument as to what the record before this court shows. And I don't think there's specific facts to support a deviation from what this court held in Liefgren.
Isn't, though, we've said in those cases, though, foreseeability is usually a jury question.
Well, except I believe in Fulmer we said, the court said, the law reflects that because duty is a law question for the court, not for a jury, that foreseeability, where, I forgot which one of the justices commented about it, where it's marked and unusual, that issue is one of a law question. So it's not always a fact question on foreseeability when it is in the context of the law question as to duty. And under Liefgren, the issue is whether or not, and this is what we've been talking about here today, whether this act of Halverson was authorized or incidental to authorized conduct. That's the important consideration for this court as it was for Judge Sirska. Judge Sirska, and there's been cases I've had where he has not made rulings, was careful with this matter. He issued a 9-page written opinion. To say that he only concentrated on one issue and one alone is not an accurate assessment. He went through the case. He discussed foreseeability. He discussed the special relationship. He discussed whether this was incidental and what type of deviation this conduct was. He did not talk strictly about whether this was a heinous, horrible crime and that alone. He did not dismiss, trump, or not consider what he should have considered, what this court has told him to consider. Since this state was founded, we have recognized some parameters as to the responsibility of a principal and agent. SDCL 59-6-10 has been on our books even when we were a territory. It has gone unchanged for 150 years. The principal is responsible for no other negligence, wrongs, or omissions of his agent unless he has authorized or ratified them, even though they are committed while the agent is engaged in service. That is what our law, our common law that is developed from our codified law has recognized. And that's what Liefgren recognized. Authorization may be not specific, but it may be implied if there is foreseeability. And what is the evidence in this case that shows it was incidental to authorized conduct? There is no evidence that any employee of my client's small business in the years he has operated has ever harassed, assaulted anyone else. And he says, well, he was convicted of resisting arrest. Yes, he was. This is a cousin, Churchill relative of my client. I'd say my client, Kelly Cawthorn, but still, it's also PKJ. He's known him. He's known him throughout his life. This is not somebody that came in for a job that he didn't know about. He knew the circumstances of it. I guess what's being argued that is that the responsibility now for an employer is if you continue to hire someone after they've had an arrest, then you're doing so at your own peril. It's now a recognized cost of business.
Wouldn't that go, though, to letting the at least the cause of action with negligent hiring, supervision, and so forth go forward?
Yes, it would go. It would be very relevant and direct as to those causes of action. But it would not be irrelevant or without consideration on the foreseeability issue with respect to the first count as well. And on the foreseeability, what else do they have? They set a rap sheet of some speeding tickets. Again, without arguing what it says, the record will reflect what that shows. It shows a person also that had worked for 10 years or thereabouts for this company, had received praises from customers. This is not somebody that was a known bad person, known bad risk. This is somebody who no one can expect on the job to do what he did. None of us, if we would have hired him, would have expected that to happen. And for the same reasons, PKJ Inc. and Kelly Cawthorn, and I'm still not clear what the theory is against unrespondeat superior for an owner of a corporation. I thought that's the whole purpose you incorporated, but I still, respondeat superior applies to an officer of the company individually. I thought it was to the employer, which would be the company. There's three requirements, that's my memory, under the hiring, detention, supervision, training. And again, all of these are thrown together, just like all of the claims are thrown against all of the defendants without any separation. It has to be a legal duty. Again, a question of law for the court. It has to be a breach of that duty and a sufficient causal relationship between the breach and the harm. Restatement 317 that Mr. Nasser has talked about and indicated is the guiding light on those claims. One of the requirements under, I believe, subsection C, excuse me if I'm wrong, is that the master has to have the ability to control and the necessity to control. Those are the legal parameters for that too. And to say on that rooftop that day, one, the master was not there. He did not have the ability to stop that. Number two, the necessity to control. I would agree that if Kelly Cawthorn thought this was a bad person that could fly off and hurt somebody at a moment's notice, he better follow him around and work right next to him. But, you know, if you believe that, he wouldn't be working there. Because a small business can't have, you're working for me, but I'm going to have somebody, me or another employee, watch you at all times. I don't know if you're going to fly off at some point. There's no evidence on the record to support any of those claims. And under that civil conspiracy theory, they've not cited a single case to get around the recognized law that it requires, as Sutliff, as this court held, two or more persons, and that when you're a corporation, you are not two or more persons. You are a single entity. The only case they cite, and no other cases or arguments been made here today, is a 1985 civil rights action where two people within a same business discriminated against a person because of his nationality. That's a different than civil conspiracy.
Well, that corporation is, cannot act without its people, right?
Correct.
And Mr. Cawthorn is one of its people, so that's one person. And then if Mr. Halverson is the other person, you have two or more people.
Well, you have a corporation.
Without regard to maybe it hasn't even been, no conspiracy has been shown, but you can't hide behind the fact that you have a corporation.
Right, and corporations are responsible, no doubt about that. Under that theory of civil conspiracies, though, Setliff said you had to have two or more persons that are not part of Webb Water, I guess is a more correct case. People within the same company make a decision on the manager. The key element on that civil conspiracy, I think, under Amger and in recognition of that 1985 action, is for that has to be outside the scope of your employment. Garza, two people discriminate. That's not part of their job. That's outside their employment. So then you're correct, Justice Savers. If you have people acting outside their scope of employment, one within and one without, you clearly could have two or more persons under civil conspiracy. But the undisputed evidence, paragraph 8 of the complaint, I believe, what Mr. Nasser has said here today, he has never claimed that the acts were outside the scope of employment. And the civil conspiracy theory fails on that reason, and that reason alone, besides the other failure to show any type of conspiracy based upon the evidence.
Did Judge Sirska make that finding? That there was no allegation of outside the scope?
I believe so. His opinion, he does have a separate paragraph addressing the civil conspiracy, and I don't know his exact wording, but I believe it was based on there's no evidence. It may well have been, as Justice Sabres mentioned, there's just no evidence of any. He says he wants to speculate on it, but there's no evidence of either of these two ever sitting down, that Kim Halverson ever knew of any feelings, or that he was directed, if you see anybody from Carrier, make life tough on him. There's no evidence of that.
I don't think I said there was no evidence. I said without regard to whether or not there's any evidence.
No, I'm saying what I say there's no evidence. You were just talking about the issue of whether it's a separate issue on whether there was a civil conspiracy as opposed to two or more persons, I believe is what you were referencing.
Mr. Lewis, you now have me confused on what is in the record and what is not with respect to what Justice Konenkamp called joint animus. Are there facts showing that both Halverson and Cawthorn had animus towards Carrier?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe there's any evidence of a joint animus between shared by Kim Halverson and Kelly Cawthorn as to any type of dislike, any type of effort to do anything or act on any animus against Carrier. No animus, no evidence of any discussions about acting on any mutual dislike of them. And if the record can show that, the only thing, and I was going back to Werner, the case that you talked to, that I talked about where the you talked about, it can't be just mere allegations and argument. What happened in Werner is very similar to what happened here. There was deposition testimony, and then the deposition was supplanted with an affidavit afterwards in order to avoid summary judgment. That was done here, and that affidavit did expand on some of these things, but is not what Mr. Halverson said in his deposition. And I asked him, I said, is there anything more to this conversation? And there was nothing more indicated at that time. So it's very similar to what this court experienced in Werner. Let me...
Counsel, just one... As I understand from reading the briefs, and maybe we got to... I haven't read the record, but I guess I'm going to have to read the record here. Clearly, Mr. Cawthorn expressed an animus towards Carrier and Curlin, as I understand it, because he was a competitor. And as I understand it, Mr. Halverson, according to at least Mr. Curlin's version, Mr. Halverson clearly expressed an animus towards Mr. Curlin as a competitor. He was in the room getting some filters or some materials, and he was upset about that. Is that not in the record?
Well, the
incidents are both in the record. But that combination that somehow there was a discussion or some animus shared between them, I don't know if either of them clearly.
Oh, you're saying they didn't discuss the animus. But I guess my point is they have a shared animus in the sense that they both hate Carrier or dislike Carrier, hates True Strong maybe. I mean, you can't, after looking at what Mr. Halverson did, you got to say something's strong like hate is there. But when you look at, there's a shared animus between these two men. Mr. Cawthorn's strong expression of dislike for Carrier as a competitor, and Mr. Halverson's strong dislike for Mr. Curlin as a human being and as a competitor also.
I'm not going to excuse what Mr. Halverson did. I've taken arguments before, but that's one I don't care to take. But I don't think the fact, whatever happened there on that roof, I don't know if that was reflected because he had gone up there that day because he had animus. I mean, the fact that he was brutal in that attack, I agree with you, Justice Kohnkamp, that shows some hidden feelings. But there's nothing on this record that he said, I hate Carrier. He's an employee. There's nothing where he indicated Carrier and Curlin are somebody I'm out to get. That's what I mean. There's nothing on the record. Let me just conclude. There's no complicity under the punitive damages. And finally, on those 10 factors of Dushar that are in the Restatement of Agency 229, if you go through those 10 factors, you can't find those that fit this case. This is not a case that fits a change of approach from this court from what they've done in Liebgren. I would go through all 10 of them, but I don't have the time. Thank you.
Right. Your time is up. Mr. Nacer, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Ron. First of all, in order to defeat my conspiracy count, the defendants alleged affirmatively to the trial court that Kelly Cawthorn was the alter ego of Empire HVAC. That's in the record. In fact, I believe it's attached to my brief in the appendix. Now, they did that in order to try to create the single person which cannot conspire. And that was very clever. However, the fact is they've admitted that he is the alter ego, so that pierces the corporate veil. We don't have the problem that Mr. Luce is talking about by their own admission. Now, when an employer sets a tenor of violence and hatred and animus is probably the best word, like Kelly Cawthorn did, and it's followed by an escalated version of it by his right-hand man, we go from batting the hand away to assaulting him. And I believe that under the circumstances and the facts of this case, the totality of the facts, a jury would have the right to see that there was the complicity, that there was the communication, even though they refused to admit it.
Let me just go back, because I made a note of Mr. Luce's comment where he was quoting from you, I think, and saying that what you said is not in the record, that I'm going to harass you. He says that's not in the record.
It is in the record.
It is in the record.
I have cited, the court only has to look at the statements of undisputed facts, and it's going to come.
Is it in the transcript? Is it in the affidavit, or what is it in?
Forgive me, it is not a statement by Kelly Cawthorn. It is
right.
The testimony came from Scott Curlin.
Okay.
But must be taken in the light most favorable to Curlin.
Right, I understand that.
Right.
I don't think it has to come from
moving
party, but is it in an affidavit? Where is it?
So that we can. I can't tell you without looking, but it's either going to be in an affidavit.
All right.
Or
well, we can find it. I guess I just wanted to hear your response to that. So we, because that's
we
kinda
cited to it. As a matter of fact, it's clearly identified. It's in there. The ability to control. You do have the ability to control because the Section 317 itself says that, and case law on it says that ability to control includes the right to hire and fire and to even terminate someone. And so you do have the ability and the right and the obligation to control that person in that way. There were other things that Kelly Cawthorn could have done to exercise control over his employee, and if he was unable to, it pretty much shows that he was failing to supervise or shouldn't have had him in that position in the first place. And so we pleaded conspiracy, Your Honors, in the alternative to cover the basis on this on the scope of employment issue. If Kelly, Halverson is found to be outside the scope of his employment, then he can conspire. If he is wholly within, I even have a question about it. Okay? And so I'm not even sure of the answer. But the fact is, if he's outside, we, at a minimum, have two entities because he's not representing.
Okay, but then you said something just as you left before. You said, you know, if we say that there was, he did, this was within the scope of employment, or at least it's a factual question, then you said, if I heard you correctly, then it follows that the other two causes of action are also have to be reversed. Did I misunderstand you? It seems to me that you're contradicting your either one or the other. It's not going to be both.
The conspiracy has to be reversed if you find him to be within the scope of employment. That would be my feeling. And I
how is that going to work?
Justice Sabers was not buying that argument, and I'm kind of talking against my position here. But the fact is, I'm looking at Kim Halverson, the employee, as being outside the corporation hypothetically. Because if you sustain Judge Sirska in this case, then and say that he's outside the scope, it's not part of the employment, then I've still got a conspiracy because we have alleged those facts. Okay?
Very consistent. I have.
Yes.
Said. Okay.
Okay. Did we have to ask ourselves, did Halverson really beat Curlin up over some $3 filters, or was there a deeper issue? And there's no question that the evidence shows that for more than 10 years, Cawthorn admits his animus toward Carrier and his trying to keep them out of Sioux Falls. More than 10 years prior to this time.
Was Curlin wearing a uniform or a...
Yes, he was identified and had a
so
Carrier
it was,
uniform.
It was clear that it was on his
yes.
uniform. He was a Carrier employee.
Yes. The 10 factors...
Is Carrier in Sioux City a supplier of Carrier equipment or Carrier air conditioning
to
HVIC? And then they came in and they want to do the work too? Is that their position?
No, not quite. This is Carrier of Omaha. They are a national service organization. They install, they do much bigger units than Empire HVAC as well, but they also do the same work Empire HVAC does.
But
they are not
supply,
the supplier.
Did they supply at all to HVAC?
A different Carrier Corporation is the product producer and supplier. The evidence shows in this case that there is a local Carrier supplier that Kelly Cawthorn does business with to get his parts and his units that he installs.
And none of these not, Carrier organizations are connected?
I couldn't tell you they're totally separate, but they clearly are separate entities and don't have anything to do with the functioning of the others. Okay, that's all I really know about that. But this is Carrier Commercial, which is the service end. The supply end is not something that Curlin's Carrier is part of. And as a matter of fact, the local Carrier organization supplier in Sioux Falls is the one Cawthorn deals with, and that's the one that Cawthorn, the evidence shows, was trying to put pressure on to have the other Carrier somehow stay out of Sioux Falls. So there must be some influence flowing between the companies, but it's not a supplier. They're competitors. I think that's the best way to look at it. The 10 factors in Section 229, first of all, they're not exclusive. The section says, though, that itself. These are not exclusive factors. These are things that the restatement has identified as more or less per se factors that ought to be considered. All things considered, I do challenge Mr. Lee's. Every single thing I said is in the record, and it's documented, and I believe that that you'll find clearly that if you take these facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, this case has to be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Nasser. Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.